Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect, a production of Bristol Radio Co-op. Good afternoon and welcome to Dialect. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM 103.2 in Preston and Birmingham Unity FM 93.5 and presently Radio Verulam in St Albans as well on 92.6. Hello to you all. This week we'll be introducing our new serialisation, a life story written exclusively for Dialect by one of our volunteers, Nick Payne, who's recently joined us. It's called A Nomad's Tale, and we find it absolutely fascinating, and we hope you do too. We have an interview with Nick introducing him a little bit later on. Also in this week's show, we have Dermot O'Neill from Bristol Cairn Repair in the studio. Features this week are by Anthea Page, introducing us to the Tasmanian Delia Smith, and Tony Gosling, who you may remember last week, met Tabletop Gamers in Old Market Street. We hear the second part of that interview, and Tony will also be talking about historical games and their power to bring kids from totally different backgrounds together. And Jeff Sparks has also written a What's On Garden Song of the Week, which I will be reading out for you later on. I'm John Peters Coleman. Hello. So, first up today, I'd love to introduce our guest for this week, Dermot O'Neill. Hello.
Hello there.
You've been an architect for 10.5 years. You've been at Bristol Cairn Repair. And you've described it to me just before you came in as the most worthwhile job that you've ever done. So you're here to chat about that. So what sort of background in architecture have you had specifically?
Well, I've worked as an architect for nearly 30 years. I've worked at Cairn Repair for 10 and a half of those. And it's the most enjoyable work I've done. Cairn Repair are a local not-for-profit organisation, a home improvement agency. And we've been helping to maintain homes and providing advice to homeowners in Bristol for 24 years.
Okay, so I'm imagining the people that you're serving here are sort of the elderly and disabled and people like that.
Yeah, we work with older people aged over 60, helping them to live independently in their homes. We also work with disabled people of all ages, including people with mental health issues or learning difficulties. And we provide help and advice with repairs and home adaptations to homeowners across the city by accessing local authority grants and charitable funding.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about what sort of adaptations you do. I mean, the cliche, I suppose, is obviously the stair lift, you know, and that helps people get around. But what sort of range of things does that
have? The stair lift is quite a basic. I would stress that we don't actually do this work. We design it. And we describe it in what's called a schedule of works. It's like a specification so that we can get alternative prices for any work that's needed. In the case of a stair lift, we would need two prices for that stair lift. And then we can, because we've got the alternative prices, we can then make an application to the local authority for a disabled facilities grant.
Before this charitable organisation existed, how do people go about trying to work out if they are disabled or they're elderly, 75-year-old woman, say, how would they go about trying to work out how to get around the house and how to improve it? Would they just have to rely on?
With luck.
With luck.
I imagine. Many people are supported by their families, but many people are alone. One of the things I've heard time and time again is he used to do everything around the house, but he's been dead for 15 years and nothing has been done since because she doesn't even know it needs doing.
So what do the council do to help these people at all?
The council at the moment have maintenance assistance grants, which minor works assistance grants, sorry, and they are to a certain level up to about £15,000.
Right.
And, you know, that electrical work might cost £3,000 in a typical terraced house.
But are a lot of people aware that they can get these grants?
Or Not very many people are aware of it. If anyone's listening and needs to be aware of it, get in touch with us.
Right, let's see.
I'll certainly pass on advice on how to do that in a moment.
You mentioned people with mental health problems. That's quite interesting. What sort of adaptations might you require to your home if you have a mental health problem?
There may be a need to remove potential trip hazards if you're absent-minded, for example. There may be bathing adaptations that would help.
And what sort of range of people? You assume most elderly people is the stereotype, but what sort of range of people do you wind up actually chatting to and going to do work for?
I've worked for a 3-year-old child recently, fostered in a home, and did a bedroom and bathroom extension for them. And I've worked with a 96-year-old lady in Clifton a few years ago, who stole a kiss from me when I wasn't ready for it. We did her kitchen roof and heating and made her wiring safe.
Okay. So winter is obviously coming on strong. The nights are getting particularly colder. I mean, there's always the winter fuel payment hotline for people to ring. So when's my payment going to come through? But what else can people do to...
Well, we find that many people get anxious, very anxious at this time of the year, if they don't have central heating or have systems that have fallen into disrepair or are just no longer working. And Bristol Care and Repair can help with heating problems as well as general repair work. This year we're able to supply heating to people while repairs are being carried out on broken central heating systems. And really anyone, if there's yourself or someone you know who needs our help, if you can call our first call service on 0117 954 2222, they will offer you general advice and information on dealing with any household maintenance problems, from frozen pipes to programming your central heating system. And they can advise on finding funding for heating breakdowns or improvements, as well as keeping your house warm.
Tell me a little bit about your preconception of the elderly before you started this job and how that changed. The state of how we care for the elderly in general as a society. Did it open your eyes starting this job?
It really opened my eyes. I come from Ireland. Extended families still is the system that operates in Ireland. There are large families, so there are large networks of support. In my own family, both my mother and father were seen through illnesses into ripe old age. But there would have been nothing to help them without that in Ireland at the time.
So do you think that the society in Britain somehow is like not that conducive to the care for the elderly?
Well,
smaller families?
I actually think with grants and general information available to people in England is actually very, very good. But unfortunately, we have a new government who want to reduce a deficit of some sort, and everybody is going to suffer, and these grants could be reduced or possibly removed.
Which does bring us on to a big topic, you know, particularly that I want to cover. I mean, how have you and the charity found the last couple of years in the financial recession?
We've been absolutely fine in the last couple of years. What we're worried about is our future, especially with the government spending review.
Have you had any sort of concrete ideas of as to what sort of cuts in grants there might be, or is it all a bit iffy?
We are now completely unsure as to what repair grants are available to us next year.
No, okay, right. So what is your relationship with the local council like? Are they quite helpful towards you?
Yes, they're very supportive of care and repair. We do work well as a partnership.
So back to a more practical level, we've discussed adaptations, but what if a person is disabled or too old to, say, get on a chair and change a light bulb or something like that?
That's where our handy person service come in. We have a team of, I think it's 8 at the moment, and this service covers anything from changing a light bulb to putting up handrails on stairs to replacing a washer or a dripping tap. Many of these small jobs may seem difficult in themselves, but can make a huge difference to people if they can't do them or they can't find a reliable tradesperson that they can trust. The handy person service can carry out up to 4 hours work in one go. And for the past 4 years, we've been brilliantly supported by the Royal British Legion to help homeowners, again, over the age of 60, who've previously served in the forces. It could be an ex-serviceman or woman or a dependent or widow, or a widower of someone who served in the forces, and the Royal British Legion may be able to pay for all your costs, but they have announced that their continued commitment to our handy person service to support it.
Okay, so basically if there's any advice or people are just really not sure quite what to do or how to improve the home, or they've got an elderly relative, the best thing is basically just to ring you and you'll advise them what to do, what bureaucratic hoops you might have to jump through and what forms to fill in and how to access grants and stuff like that.
That's exactly it. Okay.
Well, the number to ring, if you're interested in any further information, 0117 954 2222. And for those who are web and computer minded, www.bristolcareandrepair.co.uk. Or if you just put Bristol Care and Repair in Google or your favourite search engine, it will bring it up. Well, Dermot O'Neill, thank you very much for coming in. And may I say, what a lovely radio voice you have.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're nice. Excuse me. Thank you for coming
in. Thank you. Bye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our next feature is from Anthea Page, and it's an interview with a celebrity chef from Down Under, Tasmania no less.
Sweet.
Tell us about your radio career.
My radio career has been, I suppose, for the last 5 or 6 years, I've been doing a regular segment on the Australian Broadcasting Commission radio in Hobart on a Thursday evening. And it's about a 20-minute, half-hour talk with the presenter. And we have call back and people ring and give us ideas for recipes, or I help them with their food problems and all that sort of thing. So,
tell us what people like to eat in Hobart.
Well, Hobart in Australia generally is very cosmopolitan. There's a great drive, and I'm certainly an advocate for this, to eat seasonally and eat locally. And in Tasmania, we have a wonderful environment. In Tasmania, we've got the most pristine air in the world. And it crosses from Africa, and the first place it hits is the northwest of Tasmania, which is where I'm from. So we're very proud of our environment and working really hard to keep it so. Being an island, we're surrounded by wonderful seafood, temperate climate that grows beautiful fruit and vegetables, and of course we're known as the Apple Isle, so there are masses of apples and pears and cherries, just... Yeah, I mean, it's a bounty. It's an absolutely beautiful part of the world to live.
Do you have kangaroo in Tasmania?
We have, we call them kangaroo, but truthfully they're wallabies. The great big grey kangaroos, you know, the boxing kangaroo that we know of Australia is actually on the mainland. But we have kangaroos or wallabies of sort of various sizes going down from, well, I don't know, probably 30 centimetres to maybe... metre and a half or something, but yes, yeah, so we do. And there's a lot of controversy about culling them, you know, such a hassle for the farmers, because the kangaroos can come in and just decimate their crops, and of course a fence is no problem to a kangaroo. So there are a lot of, I suppose, environmentalists who object to the kangaroos being, or the wallabies being culled, but it seems to be a necessity for the farmers.
What do they eat then?
They eat plants, obviously in their natural habitat. They eat the grasses and young shoots and things like that. But if they come across a paddock of freshly sprouting corn or something like that, it's just a dream. You can imagine that they're just in heaven. The past few years, we've had quite a few droughts, and so their natural habitat, I suppose, has been diminished. And so they look for crops that are just easy for them to find fodder. That drought has been broken recently, so possibly they won't hamper the farmers as much.
Do people eat wallaby?
Yes, yes, it's a wonderful food. It's high protein, low saturated fats, very, very minimal. It's a really, really healthy meat to eat.
What other animals do you get that are exotic that we wouldn't eat in Britain?
We have possum. I don't think you probably have possum. I'm not.
Do you eat possum?
People do eat possum. I'm not a fan of eating possum at all, but, you know, you do get that. Tasmania is the place of the Tasmanian devil. Tasmanian devil is a really unusual animal. It's sort of a bit like a native cat, I suppose. There's a cartoon shown in America that's called Tassie, and that's the Tassie devil. And it's an animal. It has an enormous jaw, has the capacity to just with one bite through a cow's leg. And in a night, a cow can be killed and almost eaten apart from just a few bones left. That doesn't happen very often. It's just a real tragedy that these Tasmanian devils have contracted a facial cancer. And researchers all around the world are trying to find out the reason for this. And so it's really in fear of extinction.
Is it only found in Tasmania?
Yeah, only in Tasmania. Absolutely only in Tasmania. It's a marsupial, black with a few white spots, and it growls. Yeah, so it's a real shame.
Does it attack humans?
No, normally it would try to get out of your way, just like snakes and all those other things. They really are rarely aggressive unless they're feeling totally threatened.
Have you seen one yourself?
Oh, lots. Yes, a lot. And because they're often on roadkill, which is really sad.
So going back to your cooking program, you also do a column, I believe.
Yes, I have a weekly column in the major newspaper in Tasmania called The Mercury. And I have a page where I usually give 3 or 4 recipes a week, usually on a theme, and I try to make that really seasonal. That's interesting. There's often quite a lot of feedback. It's amazing how many phone calls and letters and things you get, you know, sort of like, what about this, what about that, how do I do this? So I've been doing that now for 7 years, so that's a lot of recipes.
Do you have any Aboriginals on Tasmania?
We don't have any full-blood Aborigines because when the English came, they really tried to decimate the Aborigines. A very, very special group of people. They're just a very, very small group of people now, and I think they're a lot less than half caste. So, but people certainly with Indigenous blood who uphold the Indigenous, well, not necessarily the total way of life, very strong group of people. It's a very, very sad story.
Do you do any Aboriginal recipes?
No, not really. One of the things we have in Tasmania is shearwater, or we call it mutton bird, and they fly from the south to the north yearly, an amazing, amazing bird. And it's traditional for the Tasmanian Aboriginal people to hunt them. They have a burrow in the sandhills, and Tasmanian Aboriginal people have catch those and prepare them for sale. They like to eat them. They're very rich in oil, in probably omega-3 oils. It's an acquired taste. Some people love them, others absolutely hate them. They have a very strong smell when you cook them. Things, but of course the Tasmanian Aboriginal people lived a lot by the sea and would have eaten the wonderful oysters and mussels. So I would say mutton bird's sort of like the main Aboriginal food that we eat, as I say, apart from the natural seafood that we have in abundance.
And have you published a book about your recipes?
I had a television program for 7 years, or two in fact, called What's Cooking with Judith Sweet, and another one was Judith's Food Notes. And so when I did the television series, there were a couple of recipe books that were attached with that, but that's a long time ago now.
So dare we call you the Delia Smith of Tasmania?
Well, some people do that. I'm probably about the same age, so. But I don't know that I could say I was as wise as Delia, but that's, so been around a long time.
That was Anthea Page talking to Judith Sweet, Tasmania's celebrity chef. Now, a rather fitting song to follow, it's Australia by the Manic Street Preachers from their Greatest Hits. That was Maddox Street Preachers there with Australia. Bristol is leading the way once again. A type of hobby shop entirely new in Britain opened on Old Market last month called Cut and Thrust Games. It's not just a shop, but what's called a gaming centre, which is open 6 days a week for anyone fed up with video games who wants to play tabletop games. Dialect's Tony Gosling has been down to Old Market on a reconnaissance mission, and we heard the first part of this report last week. This week we go upstairs to the gaming table floors and take a peep at a game where the corrupted citizens of a post-apocalyptic Bristol are skirmishing with a gang of possessed rat men.
Right, so that's the ground floor. On the next two floors we've got another 18 or so gaming tables. I'll take you up there now. Nice thing about having the different levels is that it's easy enough to split different groups up. So, you know, historical players on one floor, board gamers on another. A little bit of space for all sorts of noisy people to be noisy and people who are real thinkers when they're playing to do some real thinking. It's handy having the extra space and being able to divide it up like this. The more space we can get in here, the more people we can get in here. The tables are about 6 foot by 4 foot each, and normally two people to a table. The general gist is lining your armies up along each of the long edges of the table and having them collide in the middle at some point. It's a format that's worked for a while, but the advantage of having all of these tables is that you can push a few of them together and have as big a game as you like. It's the sort of spaces that you're limited to at home. Taking over the lounge or taking over the dining table all through the weekend just isn't really an option, certainly not in my house. So we've got enough space here to do it.
I'm Alex. We're playing some Mordheim here. That's an old specialist game from GW based on their fantasy setting, where a big meteorite of weird stone crashes in the city. So it's kind of...
So this could be Bristol here, all these bits of broken bits of buildings.
Could be. A bit more post-apocalyptic, a little bit weirder, but yeah, it's a little skirmish game. Well, we've got the Skaven and the Possessed fighting against each other at the moment. So that's Ratmen and ordinary citizens of Mordheim who've been corrupted by the weird stone and started their Lovecraftian worship and mutating change into something undescribable.
How long does a game like this actually take to play out?
With a couple of players, probably about an hour or so, but you can play with more than just one person on the side, and then those usually take all evening with all the backstabbing and all that sort of stuff going on.
What's the attraction of this to you personally?
It's an old classic, so partly it's nostalgia, but also it's a lot smaller and compact than the main battle games. So each model has a lot of personality to it, and they develop over time, a bit like an RPG.
Rocket propelled grenade?
Role-playing game, you know, experience points, that kind of thing.
The characters have a bit of personality, is that what you're saying?
They've
been fighting before, maybe, in previous games?
Oh, yeah, sure. These gangs have been in about a dozen different skirmishes, so they've all acquired different skills, little stat boosts, so they play a little bit different from the initial sort of models that you would start a gang with. I'm fighting with a possessed warband against James with a Skaven. Are both very close combat oriented gangs, and James has got the jump on me in this scenario. I've been searching the ruins for treasure and had to spread out, whereas James has come in a concentrated burst, and I'm desperately fighting his guys off until my reinforcements can come in and try to turn the tide.
Now, some of the characters are painted and some of them are white. Is that just because you haven't got round to getting your brush out yet?
Pretty much. I did have an undead...
They look a bit ghostly.
They did. I did have an undead gang to start off with, and they just sort of ran away. And when the gang started to get completely unbalanced, then it stops being so much fun. So I hit the reset button, as it were, with some models I'd had kicking about, and I just about got them, you know, game ready. And then I've been sort of frantically keeping up with the pace of new developments of the gang, adding in new models, converting them in.
In 45 minutes or whatever, when you finish, who's going to win?
I really can't say at the moment, but James has got the definite edge. I've got 2 casualties, he's got none so far. So I've basically got to pull something out in the next couple of turns. But I think I could do it. Fingers crossed.
Here we go, we're on the way up to the third floor now. We'll see what's going on. Just going past the notice board. We've got a few of those dotted around the spot with news of upcoming tournaments, leagues, escalation leagues, and various competitions and bits and pieces that we're getting up to. And it looks like there's possibly one game in progress here. Other than that, there's a bunch of people setting up their bits, moving a few things around. But well, another 8 or so tables up on this level. At the moment, we've got a introductory slash a teaching game going on here, where we've got a fairly experienced tournament player who's possibly looking to take this poor chap to the cleaners, but I'm sure he'll go gently on him. But yeah, that's an army of space warriors all in servo armour and all sorts of exciting things versus an unruly feral orc horde.
This looks like something from maybe Star Wars, or if from my generation, Blake 7, or you know, some planet far away.
My name's Alan. I've set my army up on my side of the table. Jack set his up opposite me, and he's got first turn. So he's moving his guys up to try and attack mine and hopefully steal the supplies in the middle of the table and see me off the table.
Do you normally take on young novices then? Because you're quite a damp hand at this, aren't you?
I'm just giving Jack a bit of a training game as he wants to learn how to play.
I know how to play, so it's probably not going to be that much of a walkover because I have orcs and I outnumber him a lot.
Now, has someone twisted your arm to get you down?
No, I like it. Well, if you look in the Warhammer shop, there's lots of kids my age there.
A small game like this might last for about an hour or so. Larger games, they go on a bit longer. There's a lot of luck involved, but there's also a lot of probability. So if you've got good math skills, you can work out good chances of getting the army to do what you want and kill the bad guys you want to. In my case, I've got a much smaller elite army of highly trained space troopers, so I've got to try and not get involved, hang back, use my firepower where I can, whereas Jack's got to try and get his army involved and try and use his outnumbering to his advantage.
What about the landscape? Because it looks like there's sort of old freight containers.
That's part of the appeal, really. In here, we're sort of an abandoned cityscape from an industrial area. So it represents high-value areas that armies would fight for.
This is sort of Avonmouth in 1,000 years' time, maybe?
Pretty much exactly like that.
As I said before, on Old Market Street, it's 61 Old Market Street. It's just a little bit further up from the Evening Post building, if you know that. Opening hours are from Tuesday through till Saturday, with late nights on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And the website is www.cutandthrustwargaming.com. So you can find out a bit more information about us there and elsewhere on the internet if you have a quick Google search or a Google Map search for us.
Alex Kolodochko there from Britain's new game centre, Cut and Thrust Games on Old Market, and he was talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling. Evening Open, as Alex said there, is on Tuesday and Thursday. Tony Gosling's joining me now to talk more about historical gaming. Hello.
Hi, John.
Are there not already gaming centres around? Like,
is it Games Workshop you're talking about?
Yeah.
Well, I think what this place is, the way it's different, is it's much more to do with actual playing the games themselves rather than buying the figures, painting. So there's actually loads of space with loads of tables in the upper floors. So what most of the people are doing there is actually playing the games rather than talking about them, buying them, painting them or whatever.
I see, right. Now, this all sounds a little bit still like escapism for nerds. So.
Well, to a certain extent it is, but also particularly the historical games, there's another element to it, which is historical learning. And also to understand how we got where we are today, it's quite interesting to take a look at particular battles or wars throughout history to see why one outcome was so decisive rather than another. These magazines, there's 2 main historical gaming magazines, and what happens is they come out every 2 months. And you get a magazine which has got articles about particular battles, particular wars.
Okay, so
I've got one here, for example, which is Strategy and Tactics, which is a very general wargaming magazine. And the issue is devoted to 1066, the Battle of Hastings.
Okay.
So you open it up and there's articles about 1066, a load of historical research.
A map of the layout and who all the troops were and
stuff
like that.
It gives you an idea of the different characteristics of the different people who were fighting.
Okay.
Who were the Normans? There's an article saying prelude to Hastings because there was a big battle that went on before the Battle of Hastings.
Quite meaty academic looking articles in there. So how does this translate to a tabletop game then?
Well, as you can see, if you open the middle of the game magazine, you get actually quite a nice big lots map of here. As this is the Battle of Hastings here, you've got a poster-size, full-colour map of Britain with various little... I don't know if Bristol's here, because this is before the days of Bristol. There's Bath, you can see on this map, and Winchester and places like that.
So these are some of the Roman forts all...
These were the big Saxon cities.
Okay. And I see you've also got lots of stickers to play with that come with it as well.
And you've got the French, a lot of the French from Normandy as well, down at the bottom there. And so you just battle away, basically. And the other thing you get with this magazine is you get a counter sheet, which is loads of little counters.
Sort of the equivalent of like the old ops table, like the classic war movie. You have all the little wooden ships and you push them around with sticks.
In the cabinet war room or in the map room of the White House.
Gaming equivalent of that.
It is. But what you're able to do here is you're at the same starting point as the original people who were, whatever, with William and Harold scratching their heads at the first day of the Battle of Hastings saying, look, what should I do and how's it going to go? You have a chance to sort of reenact that and see if you can do better.
Okay, so what sort of variety of people can turn up? Is it lots of spotty teenage young men who are not getting any girlfriends?
Well, you'd be surprised to hear that actually there's quite a lot of girls at the Game Centre too. And I was chatting with some of them. They didn't actually want to be interviewed. Most of the people don't want to be. They just want to get on with their game. Mm. But yeah, there are some women, girls there too.
Okay, right. You won't find any West Indians or Somalis at the Cut and Thrust games, I imagine, though, are you really?
No, well, you imagine wrong, because you do, actually. There's quite a lot of youngsters of all shapes and sizes, certainly all ethnic groups there.
Mm. Right, okay. How does this all relate to the world of video games? Is there any overlap, particularly?
Well, I think what happens is a lot of people play these video games, young people, and then eventually they realise, well, I'm just sitting here on my own or with my mate in the house, and it's a little bit stifling. What the Game Centre is able to do is, first of all, to get the youngsters away from the television and away from the computer game, the console or whatever it is, and actually to make something quite social and a learning process of it.
Can you recommend any gaming magazines?
Well, yeah, there's two, Strategy and Tactics. Both come from the US. They're both very good. One is Strategy and Tactics, and the other one's called World at War. They come out every month. They alternate. One month it'll be World at War, next month Strategy and Tactics. We've got some things coming up the next few months with Strategy and Tactics. At the end of this year, for example, are issuing a game, a magazine, all about the Partisan War in Yugoslavia and the Second World War. The cost, just let me say the cost, because this is all quite important. One issue, generally about £20. 12 issues, which is 2 years subscription, is £180.
Okay, and are they, we ask ourselves with Conspiracy Mind, sponsored by the military to train young people to become military?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because, of course, this is exactly the sort of thing that goes on now in the military war colleges. That they do a lot of war gaming.
Oh, okay. Right.
So I think there's some people who are ex-military who are involved in designing the games.
Okay, so once again, that's on Old Market Street, and the evening open, as Alex said there earlier, is on Tuesday and Thursday. Tony Gosling, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Since our latest serialisation, Secrets and Lies by David Southwell, came to an end last week, we've been thinking of new stories that we at Dialect would like to tell. And luckily, or more specifically, volunteering Bristol brought us Nick Payne by chance. Nick has had an eventful life, to say the least, from carpet salesman to actor, and at one point even homeless. Our executive producer convinced Nick to write his life story, and from next week, we will be hearing A Nomadic Tale. So, in order to introduce Nick and his story, I had a bit of a chat with him. Oh, it's my pleasure to introduce a local actor, Nick Payne. Hello.
Hello.
So, whereabouts in Bristol do you live?
Well, actually, I live in Cleve.
Okay, right. And for the uninitiated, where is Cleve? I can't remember.
Cleve is equidistant between Bristol and Weston-super-Mare.
Okay, right. And I understand you're an actor.
I am an actor, yes.
Right. How long have you been an actor?
Well, if you ask my brother, I've been an actor all my life. But actually, professionally, I've been an actor for about 5 years.
Okay, right. So what have you been doing all the time up until then?
Lots of different things. I've been a salesman, I've been a hippie, I've been a tramp, I've been quite a varied life. I'm a bit of a nomad.
Bit of a nomad, right. So how did that interact with your desire finally to become an actor? What prompted you? Did you wake up one day?
Well, actually, no. It was way back, way in Halifax, when I went to Halifax for a job. And I wanted some sort of social outlet, so I walked into a theatre. Age 19, and the feeling I got from walking in there was quite magical, and I've been pursuing it ever since, but never quite fulfilled it somehow. I've always been sidetracked by more important things, maybe.
So how did you finally succeed?
Well, I guess I came to a point in my life where it was pretty desperate and I'd really hit the bottom rung, so I thought I had nothing to lose. Okay. I was actually street homeless.
Right. Where were you homeless?
In London.
That's a very harsh place to be homeless,
I imagine. It's a very harsh place. It's very frightening.
And what was that sort of during summer, winter, the whole
it was actually,
the whole gamut of weather?
No, it was only just during the spring.
Okay.
But it was frightening enough to make me wake up and say, your life is short.
So were you literally in the shop doorway?
Actually, I was in St James's Park.
Okay.
Which I found to be the most comfortable place to sleep.
So did you, you know, you must have just walked into the park one day and presumably thought, well, okay, I'll sleep here then. So how do you, I don't know, meet and socialise with other tramps? Or are you sort of like, well, mountain men, you avoid each other or do you club together?
You do actually avoid each other, but they have day centres where you congregate for your breakfast and handouts and change of clothes and showers and things.
I was interested, from chatting to another couple of homeless people, what money they do manage to collect, they often get mugged from them by other homeless people. Did you feel like quite threatened by a lot of the other homeless people? Was it quite a scary experience?
It is, actually. That's why I decided to stay in the park, because it seemed to be close to the Buckingham Palace and I thought the security would be pretty good.
Well, yeah, that's a good idea. So
I stayed in the park and it was actually closest to the country. I didn't feel like shop doorways or streets.
No.
I felt like sleeping on grass, so I stayed in St.
And from there, you actually succeeded in getting to Axing. So what did you actually wind up doing?
I wound up going along to a company called Cardboard Citizens, who do interactive theatre for homeless people in London. As a way of getting them re-engaged in society, they do a thing called Forum Theatre, and we toured around hostels all around the UK.
Oh, brilliant.
So I did that for a couple of years. And they do a sort of mentoring scheme whereby, after the theatre has happened, you talk to them and say, look, is there any way we can help you?
Yeah. Did you get any success stories out of that?
Well, I guess one guy I met once who is quite moving. He'd had trouble getting stuff from the SOCH, you know, from the whatever you call them these days. We call them DSS. And I just encouraged him to go back there and say something to them. And he was very shy and very... He couldn't get dole money because he didn't have an address. He couldn't get a bank account because he didn't have an address. And I just said, no, just go back in there and tell them, look, you have rights. And it was a beautiful experience. I'd spent some time with him.
Hmm.
And I got a telephone back from him. He's a very shy man and very reluctant to put himself forward. But the telephone call, I was just walking across Liverpool Street Station and I got a telephone call from this guy. And his name was Eric. And he sort of said, I went down to SOCH and asked them if I could have some money. And they said, no, you can't. You haven't got an address. And you could actually feel him, because we'd actually clubbed together that day and got him breakfast and gave him a bit of support from the people on the actors from the troupe. And it had given him some sort of strength. And you could feel him on the phone. He got hold of it and he said, I think you'll find I've got rights as a human being. And he said, within seconds, he was in the manager's office and they gave him 6 weeks back money. And I mean, it was difficult. It was difficult to get any feedback at all from people because it's a very desolate and desperate state to be in.
And imagine a lot of people in that position of being homeless are not so very sort of socially adroit, perhaps, which is part of the reason why they might be on the street.
Part of the reason why they want to be there. They don't actually want to. I mean, some very intelligent people I came across.
Mm.
And I said, well, why don't you get back in? And they say it's the pressure. They can't stand the pressure. They come to a point of engagement with society and something asks something of them and they just fold. They just completely collapse.
Mm. So what brought you to Bristol?
That's a good question. I worked on the Clevedon Interchange building the motorway in 1972.
Yeah.
I came here as a hippie and I'd lived in Bristol four or five times. So I quite like Bristol.
Do you like that? I mean, a lot of people say Bristol has a bit of a laid-back sort of semi-anarchic, sort of creative air. Did you find that when you moved here? Was that part of what attracted you?
I'm not really that much into the creative air. I just like the feeling. When I first came here in 72, I'd just been deported for minor misdemeanour from various countries. And I didn't know where to go, so I came to Bristol. Seemed good. And I walked into a little tobacconist shop. It was one of those ones where the woman, you know, they live in one room and they come through to the other room.
Yeah.
Just two rooms. And this beautiful old lady just came up to me. And I was very unsure. I had nowhere to stay. I was sleeping on the streets. I've done that quite a few times. And she just looked me straight in the eye. She said, hello, my love. What can I do for you then?
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, that will do. Bristol is very nice. And it's never let me down, actually, in all the time I've been here. They're quite gentle people here.
Bechamp. Okay, well, you came across the volunteering organisation, which sends a lot of people. Tell us a little bit about that. Did you just sort of hear about it and thought, oh, well, I'll just check out what they got?
Yeah, I guess I found out the address, just walked in there literally yesterday and got seen to straight away. I saw they have a whole load of vacancies up on the wall. Just looked through those and they said they had needed an actor down at Dialect Radio. We checked it out on the web. It was very, very straightforward and very, very helpful. I was quite impressed, actually, by the whole place. You're not made to feel... You're made to feel very welcome and encouraged to pursue whatever it is you want to do. So I'm very grateful for them.
Okay. Well, if you want to check that out on the internet, volunteering, it's Volunteering Bristol. If you put that in, that will immediately bring up their website if you want to visit that. Tell us a little bit. I understand you went up to Yorkshire and were part of another acting troupe there. Tell me a little bit about that. What was that like?
Oh, dear. I'm a bit of a nomad. I've lived in many different places. I was West Yorkshire. I was dispatched to West Yorkshire a long time ago, and it's always been a part of my life. So I found myself there again. And there was this company, Crag Rats, in Home Firth. And they did a lot of school work, but they also did a lot of corporate work, where they actually... People don't speak to each other in the corporate world. So what you have to do is to get them to relax. And the best way to do that is to perform a little skit involving them, but not them.
Yeah.
You know, just alongside who they might be, like caricatures of who they are.
Did you find that a lot of them were more than eager to do this and, you know, it's away from the normal work routine?
I found it, yeah, that was part of it. But they're reluctant. The higher up the hierarchy you go, the more reluctant they are to actually be exposed to something like that. But I saw the power of it. I saw the power working with a big multinational company who couldn't get through to the workforce. And you saw the workforce just as they are, completely antagonistic toward the management, and the management equally so. And we put on a little skit and it opened their hearts. It just opened them up. And it was amazing when you felt the whole congregation suddenly realise, oh no, man, we've actually got to do something here. We can't keep blaming people.
Hmm.
We can't keep pointing fingers. It's actually us. We've got to change. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? We've got to allow change to happen. And if we allow change to happen, then things can change.
So what are you doing in Bristol right now?
Sitting here talking to you.
Yeah, well, I mean, how are you sort of supporting yourself?
Here, there and everywhere.
Various ways and means.
Yes.
Okay, fair enough. Well, thank you very much for chatting to us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Well, thank you very much for Nick for agreeing to chat to us there and for writing a life story. So we look forward to hearing part one of A Nomadic Tale next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
We have two poems this week, both read by Roddy Peters. The first poem is called A Soldier, His Prayer, written by an anonymous soldier. The second poem is called The Silent One, and was written during World War I by the Gloucester poet Ivor Gurney.
A Soldier, His Prayer. This anonymous poem was blown by the wind into a slit trench at El Algeila during a heavy bombardment. Stay with me, God. The night is dark. The night is cold. My little spark of courage dies. The night is long. Be with me, God, and make me strong. I love a game. I love a fight. I hate the dark. I love the light. I love my child. I love my wife. I am no coward. I love life. Life with its change of mood and shade. I want to live. I'm not afraid. But me and mine are hard to part. Oh, unknown God, lift up my heart. You stilled the waters at Dunkirk and saved your servants. All your work is wonderful, dear God. You strode before us down that dreadful road. We were alone and hope has fled. We loved our country and our dead. We could not shame them, so we stayed the course and were not much afraid. dear God, that nightmare road, and then that sea. We got there. We were men. My eyes were blind, my feet were torn, my soul sang like a bird at dawn. I knew that death is but a door. I knew what we were fighting for. Peace for the kids, our brothers freed. A kinder world, a cleaner breed. I'm but the son my mother bore. A simple man, and nothing more. But, God of strength and gentleness, be pleased to make me nothing less. Help me, O God, when death is near, to mock the haggard face of fear, that when I fall, if fall I must, my soul may triumph in the dust. Who died on the wires and hung there? One of two. Who for his hours of life had chattered through infinite lovely chatter of Buck's accent, yet faced unbroken wires, stepped over, and went. A noble fool, faithful to his stripes, and ended. But I weak, hungry, and willing only for the chance of line, to fight in the line, lay down under unbroken wires, and saw the flashes, and kept unshaken, till the politest voice, a finicking accent, said, "Do you think you might crawl through there? There's a hole." In the afraid darkness shot at, I smiled, as politely replied, "I'm afraid not, sir." There was no hole, no way to be seen. Nothing but chance of death, after tearing of clothes kept flat, and watched the darkness, hearing bullets whizzing, and thought of music, and swore deep hearts, deep oaths, polite to God, and retreated and came on again. Again retreated, and a second time faced the screen.
That was Roddy Peters, reading two poems about war. Next up, our What's On Guide. Unfortunately, Jeff is on his holidays once again, so he can't be here to present it himself, but, dutiful as ever, he has provided his gig and music recommendations for the week ahead, and the charming Michaela Dennis is here to say it. Hello.
Hello. Good afternoon. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect, starting with Thursday the 21st of October, and as part of the M4 tour, Void will be performing with support from Underline the Sky and also The Goodness at The Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8pm, and tickets are £4 in advance. On to Friday the 22nd of October, Buddy Whittington will be performing with support from AFGN at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 and tickets are £12 in advance and £14 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and let me present Red Hot Chili Pipers. They performed in 2004 in Scotland and to date have released four albums. This is from the 2008 released album. It's called Blast Live and it's a track entitled Highland Cathedral.
Thank you.
That was Red Hot Chili Pipers with Highland Cathedral from the album Blast Live. For more information, you can check out www.redhotchilipipers.co.uk. Now on to Saturday, the 23rd of October, Chrome Hoof will be performing with support from Teen Girl Fantasy at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8pm and tickets are £8 in advance. And finally, on Sunday, the 24th of October, Woolly Bullies will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 4pm and entry is free. That's all from Jeff. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Michaela Dennis and Jeff Sparks. Mention of Woolly Bullies there, of course, that was a hit for Sam the Sham and the Phony Pharaohs back in the 1950s. Well, that's all from Dialogue Radio this week. Our studio guest was Dermot O'Neill. Thank you very much to him for coming in. And our features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, who also spoke to, and I also interviewed Nick Payne, of course. The engineer was Michael Noyes. Jeff Sparks wrote the What's On Guide, and the producer was Michaela Dennis. It's goodbye from me, John Peters Common, and I shall see you all next week. Goodbye.
A vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone, streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold and damp, when my eyes were stabbed by the flash of a neon light. Split the night and touch the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, people writing songs that voices never share. No one did the sound of silence. Fool said I, you do not know. Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words that I might teach you. Take my arms that I might reach you. But my words like silent raindrops fell. The people bowed and prayed to the neon god they made, and the sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, tenement halls, whispering.